there's a lot of optimism with Pierce because the Democratic Party was viewing him as the standard bearer. He goes from this compromise, and this is a funny thing that gets lost with Pierce. They act like he's a compromise candidate his entire electoral run. No. Mm-hmm. He was a senator. He was a rep. He knows how to be a politician. He's not a dark horse as if they just grabbed some guy. He's not Harry Truman. He's not, I was working in a furniture factory, now I'm the president. But no, he's not. The Democratic Party actually breathes a sigh of relief at one point and goes, okay, we got Franklin Pierce.
All right, welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, a podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. My name is Kyle, the Frank to Eric's Joe, and for today's mystery, the history boys are trying to figure out who pierced the president. I mean, who was Pierce the president? Eric?
Well, before I start, Kyle, let me ask you a question. How many colleges or universities are named after presidents?
Universities, not like high schools?
Yeah, just universities.
It seems like the high schools get named more. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, there's stuff. There's literally a Wikipedia page for all the schools, all the high schools.
I mean, I know there's like Washington University. So, okay. So there's at least like those. I don't know, maybe like a dozen?
Okay. Handful? So you're more than I guessed. The definition of Washington University gets hard here.
Okay. Oh, but how many of those are there?
Yes.
Right.
All right, so there are, according to my count, so people please can correct me on here, there's 8 colleges that are named after presidents, right?
Okay.
George Washington University, Washington College, Washington Jefferson College, Lincoln University of Pennsylvania, Lincoln University of Missouri, Truman State University, which is the only university renamed after a president in the modern era, Roosevelt University. Oh, I mean, talk about titans, right? You have the founder of the country. You have the people.
How many times are you counting the Jefferson? There's one on there where I think you said 2 names on one school.
Yeah, there's a university called Washington and Jefferson College.
Does that count as 2 or 1?
I'm counting that as 1.
Okay.
1 college named after 2 presidents.
I think we got 7 then. I think you missed one in there then.
I have 1. So Washington, obviously George Washington. I mean, literally one of the best colleges in the world. And, you know. But they're all named after really prominent presidents. You could maybe argue that the list I just said, Truman is the least accomplished of all of them.
But he kicked off the nuclear era. So, I mean, I guess he kind of gets that at least.
Served, was able to serve multiple terms. Many interesting things under Truman. He ushered in the modern era, the post-World War II state of affairs. And he's probably the lowest billed on that. Except for there's one more. Franklin Pierce University.
Where is that? Is it?
It's in the home state of Franklin Pierce, the only president from the great state of New Hampshire, the Granite State.
Pierce is from New Hampshire.
Pierce is from New Hampshire. He's the only president from New Hampshire.
So I did a little bit of reading ahead, not on purpose. I was trying to research something else, and I did not see anything that looked great as far as.
He's the. One of the worst presidents.
Okay. That's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah. It is interesting because Polk was a better president, but a worse person.
Right.
Franklin Pierce, because Polk is the worst, I think, from an ethical standpoint, president we ever had. I would argue that. Anytime you're buying slave children while you're president you're the worst.
Yeah.
I think the worst. I do always like pulling that on people. Like, oh, who's the most unethical president or something like that? And they'll be like, oh, Richard Nixon. I'm like, oh, Richard Nixon had some people break into a hotel room. And I'll be like, have you heard of James K. Polk? They're like, yeah. I'm like, bought slave children as president. And they're like, oh, that's – so he's the worst. He's the worst human being.
I thought James Buchanan didn't get a very good glowing recommendation from you either.
Oh, no, he's the worst president because, we keep talking about things that cause and plant the seed for the Civil War. He was just like, let's have a Civil War. And he tried to do it as there's an argument that some revisionists make for Buchanan that he's the most successful president because he accomplished everything he said he was going to do as president.
Oh, that sounds like an argument I'll make.
That is an argument you would make. It's literally definitely. A Kyle argument.
I hate myself for that too.
And I like, yes, but you are also as president responsible for the outcomes of your decision, which is,
yes.
Which is why I am a very bizarre Martin Van Buren supporter. I don't want to say supporter. I'm a very like Martin Van Buren, like he is better than people rank him as because of the stuff he did during his presidency, like for modern banking in the United States and the world. So like,
dude, anybody who gets Frederick Douglass's nomination for the presidential candidate, I think it was 1848. I mean, like you're doing something, right?
Yeah, like it is.
You definitely completed the redemption arc, I think, at that point.
Yeah, he's just an interesting cat. Martin Van Buren gets lost to history because he's in the shadow of Jackson, while also like really showing the incompetency of Jacksonian politics. Like that's the way I think about Jacksonian politics. And this has to do a lot with Pierce. They had no legs; like they didn't sustain. You really look at Jacksonian politics Jacksonian national policies beginning in the 1830s, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't work. They didn't really yield anything besides more sectarianism, or I should say sectionalism. And I sit there and I'm like, I know we talk about in school a lot, and I know it's something that's like pop history is talking about Jackson, but like, I really, the more I study this time period, the more I'm kind of like confused on what is like, was he transformational? Oh, of course he was. Mm-hmm. Of course he was. I'd be a fool to argue that. Yeah. But can I point to his long lasting policies that worked? It's like, no.
Can you find any? Yeah.
No, right? Like you can. And I've heard the argument before. Like, oh, Eric, you know that argument's more of a there's a recency bias there. I'm like, no. Like, Madison. Absolutely. Madison had policies that lasted.
Monroe.
Honestly, Monroe's policies are still even being discussed today. You could argue that a lot of what John Quincy Adams did, forming a professional public servant corps.
Martin Van Buren with the banking reforms.
Right.
And I mean, come on.
But what upsets me is that in that interlude period, there are presidents that passed major lasting pieces of legislation. Mm-hmm. And Jackson just like doesn't have that. Like everything he went to do didn't become a lasting piece of legislation. Now, could you argue it was a cult of personality? If Jackson could have been president if he could have been King Andrew, right? Would it have worked? Like, I doubt it because I think policies, one of the things I learned early on working government is that if a policy makes you feel good, it's probably a bad policy. I think he had some of that true populism in him, and populism like doesn't work in the long run. Like, eventually there's a reset in it. But no, it's in. So I find it interesting to have this discussion on Pierce, and I think there's actually something cool about Pierce ending this season, ending our antebellum season, because he so perfectly epitomizes the chaotic mixing of opinions that are occurring right now that are gonna that do get suppressed out, or I should say expressed out during the Civil War. Like, Kyle, we're about to go on a journey of one of the most confusing political stances you will ever hear in your life, and I love it. He is very confusing political opinions.
More confusing than Taylor's?
Oh yeah. I mean, Taylor was a man. Taylor was like a man in crisis between like his just refusal, like the view of like his personal life owning, like being one of the large slave owners in the United States, mixed with having this idea of like slavery not being something that's allowed to tear apart the union. And we're going to flip this with Pierce. Pierce is the opposite of Taylor. He was a brigadier general during the Mexican-American War.
So he'll be the least slaveholder owner president, but also the most pro-slavery president. Is that what you're saying?
That's what he is.
No kidding.
No, that's actually what he is. So our dear friend, Franklin Pierce, as we begin this story, anybody really knows the presidents knows that nobody knows anything about him, and he is by far one of the worst presidents, and man, did he earn that reputation.
Dude, the only thing I know about him is his campaign slogan, which was poked in what year, and then pierced in 48,
yeah.
Or 52.
52, yeah. 56. 56 was Buchanan.
Oh, okay, 52.
Who will be... Yeah. Mercilessly mocked by me, like honestly, non-objectively too. Like it'll be a problem. The only president hailing from the Granite State, By the way, when I was a kid, I used to hate seeing the Granite State license plates because Quincy's the Granite City. And I'm like, took it from us.
Very jealous over there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, very. Yeah. Petty. Petty is the word that I wish I was smart enough to be jealous. But that used to upset me. But then, like, Quincy's also the city of presidents, which seems like a better moniker than the Granite City. But
Right.
So the story of Franklin Pierce begins on November 23rd, 1804, where he's born in Hillsborough, New Hampshire, which is a beautiful place in New Hampshire, by the way. I do like this because a lot of these places I have been. So he's born to Benjamin and Anna Pierce. It's very easy to remember Franklin Pierce's mom's name because it's Anna Kendricks.
What?
Yeah, Anna Kendrick Pierce is the his mom's name. I don't know. I found that funny. So his dad was a Revolutionary War veteran, and he was a very prominent local figure who actually eventually served two terms as governor of New Hampshire. And so he grew up in this like very, very politically active household. And what's funny is his household was very traditional Democratic Republicans for his childhood. So what's funny is you begin to think of – we begin to frame Franklin Pierce's political leanings. It's important to remember that he grew up in a very, very politically engaged household whose system of thought did not match the system of politics he would eventually go into. Now, his family did eventually fall in line with what we would consider non-Jacksonian Democratic leanings, you know, after the Democratic-Republican Party kind of fell apart. But it does very much come to – we'll see this percolate throughout the story of Pierce, of kind of being a man who in many ways was your pre-Civil War Democrat, but also in many ways held beliefs that kind of didn't make sense because these were core beliefs that were – I didn't say don't make sense. That's not fair to Franklin Pierce. I'm trivializing. And I apologize for that. That don't line up with traditional party platforms and don't really make sense for a northerner really hold. And – so he's born in 1804.
Affluence of the family?
Upper income. I don't want to say objectively wealthy.
Not like the elite class, like a not like a Jefferson or
not a Miller. He's not Miller Fillmore or Zachary Taylor. Early life Zachary Taylor. He's more. I don't know. John Quincy Adams-y.
Okay, yeah.
Like, your family's doing
family's
okay.
Well off. You probably don't have, you probably can't just sit on your butt and not do anything for the rest of your life, but you also don't have to work that hard.
Yeah, you're not Miller Fillmore, who's like, I need to have a business when I'm 14, because I would like to eat.
Right,
it is real cool, if you really think about it, how eclectic the presidential backgrounds are. Even, this is the early 1800s in the world. Like, there was 14. No meritocracy. Yeah. No place else in the world was somebody who had to do hard labor from their early childhood rising to the top of a country. That just wasn't going on anywhere.
Maybe that guy, a Dutch guy.
The guy just literally didn't speak the language, which is wild to me. Dude, I really think we need to pop up Martin Van Buren more. So in his early adolescence, he attends local schools around Hillsborough. It was kind of cool because Hillsborough is still very rural at the time, still very heavy farming community. And so he ends up attending different schools up there, but his dad is rising politically as he's going to these rural schools. So there's kind of this cool dichotomy where he's, in a more sparse area. He's getting a good education, but in his home life, his dad is rising in state politics, and that creates this really interesting viewpoint that Franklin Pierce starts to develop of being in this community, but realize rural community, small community, being in that community, but then contextualizing that against what he's hearing from his father and watching his father climb to the top of New Hampshire politics. And then you also have to mix in that his dad was a Revolutionary War vet. So you have these interesting tidal forces where it's a very, very fundamentalist viewpoint on Union first, a Union first guy, because his dad instilled in him the founding of the American experiment. With that sparse upbringing, and not an upbringing of need, but then also seeing his dad actionably climb through the political ranks in – this really starts culminating when he goes to college. So he goes to Bowdoin College in Maine. It was 1824, so he was Well, he went there. So he graduated in 24. He went in 1820. So it's literally just when it became Maine. It was Massachusetts before.
Actual four-year degree.
Yeah, an actual one, yeah. No, the first person we have who went to college for the normal amount of time at a normal age. He was 16. He was 16. That's a lawyer.
I mean, that's normal-ish.
Yeah, I was 17 when I went to college. I guess it's not that bad. So while he's there, he starts developing all these social and political relationships with different people around New England. He's seen as a good student and, not top of your class by any standpoint, but really thoughtful. But he started really showing interest, not just in law, but in electoral politics, because he's seen his dad do it. So he starts understanding the idea of you elect a set of politics, not necessarily just a politician.
Did he and his dad get along well? Did his dad have the same viewpoints as he did once we get to later on? Because it sounds like a completely different person at this point.
So it is kind of interesting. We don't have anything on their interpersonal relationships I could find. But given what I could find, what I was reading up on his dad, I don't know. I don't want to say they had polar opinions, but I definitely think you're in the right direction, Kyle. But there was their foundation was the same, which is this union first, right? That the union must preserve.
Oh, he just went to the wrong side of the.
That's what I think would happen. That's what I think happened.
Okay.
So, he graduates college in 1824. And he immediately starts a legal apprenticeship. And he studied law through, the normal path, essentially clerking for an already established attorney. Though, interesting enough, he did kind of the opposite of a lot of presidents who become lawyers. He was already a party organizer by the time he had passed the bar. So he became – this is where we begin to understand every president – this sounds stupid. Every president who was elected was elected. So even though we talk about these presidents, he was a horrible president, blah, 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 all that stuff. Like, no, you
still
won an election.
Enough support, yeah. Enough of the country liked him, yeah.
Yeah, we can't look at history as flat. We have to look at it as historiography, like the idea of looking at history through the people who lived it. And so while he's there, he develops this very noticeable ability to drive electoral politics. And he's in his early 20s at this point. He's 21, 22. But he's also a very successful attorney in court. He's seen as a kind of this relentless advocator. He's an attorney you want on you. He's not a constitutional attorney, right? He's not a James Madison. I like how I picked the most constitutional attorney of all time.
I know, right?
That's so unfair to compare literally anybody to James Madison. But at the time, if you remember, this is just when we start seeing little dips and dabs of the idea of party organization in the United States. We haven't reached William Henry Harrison's presidency yet, but we're definitely within earshot of it. Sometimes history happens all at once. Sometimes history takes time. But in this case, we are seeing this percolation of party organization. And Franklin Pierce is very young and very good at it. By 1829, he's elected to the New Hampshire House of Representatives. He's very young, but he became known as a very dependable Democratic figure in the state and the state legislature. And what was unique about it is that, again, this is 1829, so we're talking about 25-year-old, is that he's not only seen as a humble and bright young man, but he's seen as very, very good at advocating. And something you'll see over and over again is how he's described. It's not so much that he will debate you. It's not so much that he's kind of like quiet man Zachary Taylor, right? It's not so much like he's a John Quincy Adams where he's just smarter than you. And I often think John Quincy Adams wish people were smarter than him because he probably would have had more success. But he's seen as this kind of relentless figure of when he pushes something, he pushes for it. He doesn't do it in a way that inherently upsets people, but he does it in a way that he's not unbiased at all.
It almost sounds like he wears you down.
Kind of, yeah. He's just, right. And he's not unmovable. But once he takes a position, he's hard to convince otherwise. So by 1831, or by the time he's 27, he actually becomes the Speaker of the House for New Hampshire. Yeah. Oh.
Still, state Speaker of the House is nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, 27. Yeah, because then you have to be 25 even to run for Congress.
How many people are in New Hampshire at this point in time?
It's still very, very, very sparsely populated. I think it only has a handful of electoral college votes. So I think that put it somewhere in like the hundreds of thousands. But even today, New Hampshire's a fairly sparsely populated state.
And it's still, even now, it only has like, what, 3 or 4 votes?
It's like 3 or 4 million, yeah.
Yeah.
It's first primary in the country. That's kind of cool. Random New Hampshire fact. So after he rises to prominency as Speaker of the House, of New Hampshire, he is, there was kind of the, not questioning, but it's interesting to put somebody that young as Speaker of the House, but the party, he lived up to the expectations and the party fell behind him. So now the Democratic Party is looking at a young, bright, clearly politically savvy organizer who was able to do the job, and he was able to do the job well.
Yeah, but we're also getting to the point where that party's about to transform, I guess, at the best of words. Collapse would be the other way of saying it.
Oh, you are very right, my friend, because in 1833, he gets tapped to run for the U.S. House of Reps for New Hampshire.
Oh.
And he wins. And he wins well. So he enters the U.S. House. He's representing New Hampshire. And he consistently aligned himself with the Jacksonian Democrats at the time. Because right now, it's 1833. You're really looking at, like, remnants of the Democratic Republican Party, which is now kind of like the National Republican Party, which was kind of an interesting part. And we had a conversation on this. Like, I still go back and forth that that's a party. Parties have to have platforms, and I don't think the National Republicans had a platform. So he aligns himself with there, and he liked. I'm gonna use the word that was used, even though I always like to get my own spin on stuff, make it worse. Priorities. He agreed to the priorities of the Jacksonian Democrats. He had very limited government instincts. For somebody who was so involved in government, viewed government as a tool, he didn't naturally trust government. He believed in good policies, but limited government. Mm-hmm. And he shared skepticisms of the concentrated financial power that could come from, say, like a central bank. So
you say he believed in good policies, but he aligned himself with Jacksonian politics?
He believed in limited policies. He wanted good policies and limited government.
Okay.
Yeah, right. But he never, at least in this time period, he has yet to branch out from New Hampshire. All his major contacts are still in New Hampshire. He's still this hyper-regionalized political figure, despite his rise to prominency and his ability to interact positively with the dominant party of that era. You know, he takes a quick side trip in 1834, so around when he turns 30, he marries Jane Appleton, who's from from New England also, and it's funny because he's just gregarious politician. He's a politician's politician, Franklin Pierce. One of the funny things when you're around, especially politicians at the national level, is they're very likable. That's how they get elected.
Right?
Like every politician that I hear people like. Oh, rant on left or right, rant about it. I'm like, yeah, but that person, if you met them, you'd like them.
Have you met a politician you didn't like? Like, once you actually sit down and talk to them, right? I mean,
everybody hates Congress. Everybody loves their congressman.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I've met politicians who I don't share a single belief with, who I'm like, oh, yeah, I can see why they get elected. I'm a likable person. But Jane was very private. She did not like public life at all. She didn't want to be seen. She knew she loved her husband. Mm-hmm. There were social and political advantages to their marriage because of how prominent the Appleton family was in New England at the time. But with that said, everything appears
to be... We know that's the blueprint to success for the...
marry a rich woman from... either Virginia or New England, and you will have success. But she very much did not like the politics side of it. She didn't like public life. She just wanted to go do her own stuff, which is cool to me. I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
So there was definitely advantages to the marriage, but by everything I could tell, it wasn't a marriage of convenience. It was a marriage. It's always hard to speculate because you're not in their lives, but they seem to love each other.
No.
They did have 3 kids, but unfortunately none of them survived to adulthood.
Oh, man, I hate when you hear that.
Yeah, there was Frank Jr. He died as an infant. Frank Robert died as from typhus at age 4. And Benjamin Pierce died at 11 in a train accident. That happened just before the inauguration, which is...
Oh, that is... God, I thought Calvin Coolidge had it rough.
Yeah, that is horrible. Imagine, like, you know, you're getting ready to get sworn in to be president, and then there's a train derailment, and you lose your son.
Yeah, not only that, but this is, like, when trains are new.
Yeah, dude, I didn't even think of that. Yeah, right? Like, oh, geez, why does that get so much worse? So he ends up, so he serves out the rest of his time in the U.S. House of Reps. So in 1837, he gets tapped again by the Democratic Party, and they say, hey, we...
there's a bit of a panic going on. Can you help us?
That's like literally what they said. They were like, right? Hey, can you run for the Senate? So he's like, yeah, sure. And he served during this, you know, very financially in unstable time period, but also had so many party conflicts. This is because if you remember during this late 1830s, early 1840s, the Democratic Party without Jackson as prominent, is really trying to define itself. You can make an argument. It did not define itself in this period because it did have this weird fractionization.
It kind of felt like it fell apart, and Martin Van Buren had to go course correct.
Yeah, exactly. And he became, you know, known less for his national leadership, but he did become very well known for his loyal party service. And he became known as very politically reliable. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like he was a rubber stamp yes vote all the time, but he was known as somebody who you could explain your position to and explain the importance of it to your platform, especially in such a period of instability, that he became just very reliable about getting his points across, being able to act in a efficient manner, especially relative to everything that was all the horrific stuff that was going on at the time.
It sounded like he was their whip.
He was a little bit like a whip, dude. He really
did. They have whips at this point?
Yes, but I don't think we'd consider them like whips we have today.
Right.
I think he would be...
It sounds a lot more modern take of that, yeah.
Yeah. So 1842 comes around, it's getting up for re-election. He decides he doesn't want to run again, so he resigns. And he chose to return to New Hampshire. He started a private law practice, and he kind of just took a break from national politics. And he enjoyed himself. He enjoyed being an attorney. And so for the next 4 years, he kind of just is an attorney. He's still very involved in the Democratic Party, but he's all working behind the scenes. He's a son of a governor, former senator, former rep, former speaker of the state house. He has all these connections, and he's a competent attorney. But he can't really shake the political side of it. Mm-hmm. He really wants to... Let me rephrase that. He really believes that there are ways in which, no matter how controversial, and this is where the slavery topic starts occurring over. And remember, he didn't have slaves. He grew up in New Hampshire.
That's so weird.
It's very weird. It's very weird. Okay. So he ends up having these kind of like dialogues. I'll begin to describe those internal dialogues. And you see it. I mean, obviously, I tell everybody, read the historians. They're better writers than I am, than all of me. But you start to see this like, this internal dialogue that's occurring within the Democratic Party, and this internal monologue that's occurring inside Pierce, where he's helping support this Democratic Party that he loves. See, and he loves the platform, but it's evolved away from that Jacksonian democracy, and as it's trying to find itself, it is noticeable to Pierce that it's forming these two bubbles, where you're seeing the Southern Bloc that would exist for... We're in the 1840s, 120 years, Southern Democratic Bloc. I don't know when the Bloc broke, but I think it's like the 60s or 70s it's considered broken.
Yeah, something like that.
And what we see more of the Northern faction of the Democratic Party. And as this is happening between 1842 and 1846, he's still very much a Democrat, but... He's actually involved in the campaigning and the platform structure. It's not just what does Franklin Pierce believe. It's how can he influence, even though he's not elected this time, but he's a prominent lawyer and has a very prominent background. And he's still a young man. He's 42 at this point. And how can he shape these politics? And this leads to an exponential rise in his ability, his prominency in the party. But he takes, he does something that's almost a requirement at this point in time, which is he joins the military. anybody who wants to be, you know, involved in politics, wants to potentially be involved and become the president, essentially has to serve at some point. So in 1846, when the Mexican-American War breaks out, he actually went and sought a military war, he went and sought a military posting. And he's appointed a brigadier general, and it's very funny.
What?
Yeah.
Like just out of nowhere?
Yes. It was in the volunteer service, and I don't know why that gets glossed over sometimes. They're right? Like, oh, he was appointed a brigadier general. Well, even today, the U.S. government can appoint officerships to civilians if the civilian specializes in something they need, and it's like you don't get paid for it, but okay, like it can facilitate stuff.
Well, it's the difference between like a line officer and all the officers who do the doctor's works are officers. But I mean, they could be like an 06, but I mean, they're not going to be given command of a submarine.
Right. So, I want to be very clear. He was a brigadier general, but he wasn't.
He's not commanding anything.
Yes. But he leaned into it. So he ends up serving under General Winfield Scott. And so he's overseeing operations in Mexico City. Winfield Scott's overseeing operations in Mexico City at this time. And, you know, he faced criticism a lot during the war because it was during the campaign of the war because he was involved in all these key actions, all these key moments. This is the taking of Mexico City. He actually sustained injury, which
really.
Yeah, how is a brigadier general getting injured? It should be a question. I always find it very funny. So we have some good like records on his war, on his time in war.
Is he like Hamilton?
Oh no, Hamilton was crazy. I think Hamilton wanted to get shot, which is ironic to how Hamilton
did end up getting shot.
But he's not James Monroe. He's not like, oh cool, let me, you know, go take on some Hessians. So In reality, he functioned very much like what a lawyer would be good at. It's not like you fight. It's not like when you're at war. What do they say? The hardest part about war is waiting.
Not for him. It sounds like they just have him there to like draft up like surrender terms.
He's literally just like doing office work, and I think he was handling some logistics too. But not like he wasn't the guy running the wagons and stuff. It was more like, hey, we need somebody to help with this onboarding and all that stuff. But he actually wanted to get battlefield experience, and weren't.
I guess if you're close enough to the field, you might be able to figure out a way to make that happen.
Yeah, but by the time he returns home in the late 1840s, he now has a national pedigree. He has these national credentials that are really going to lead to him becoming this prominent figure in the Democratic Party. So he turns to he comes home. He does not run for office. When he comes back, he just goes back to practicing law. Well, by this point, he's considered a leader of the Democratic Party. And he does so. He's the only leader in the Democratic Party at this time who's not an elected official. At this point, it's become like being an elected official is almost like the only way to be considered part of Democratic leadership. And I'm not saying like that was uncommon for different political parties. I'm just saying at this point in time, the Democratic Party was kind of like they only wanted elected officials being up there. But given his previous elected positions and now his military credentials, very successful law practice and his own, you know, lineage, he holds a lot of sway in the party.
Right.
And
is his dad still around at this point?
I believe his dad I'm not sure when his dad passed away, but his dad, stuff I've read has referred to his dad in the past tense by this point.
Okay. But he wasn't like a Jackson or someone who lost him really early.
No. His dad, he actually in that trend finally. To him. Yeah, right. Thank God. At this point, you know, he's lost two of his sons already. So Franklin Pierce Jr. died in 1836 and Robert Pierce died in 1841. And 4 years after Robert Pierce passed away, they gave birth to Benjamin, who would pass away in the early, who was the one who would die in the train accident. Dealing with a lot of family tragedies right now. And unfortunately, one more to come. Now, by this point, we're around 1850, 1852. We start to see the National Democratic platform rip apart, foreshadowing something that Pierce had, you know, previously been exposed to, which is this Southern Democratic bloc and these Northern Democratic bloc not being really able to agree on anything. So by this point in time, you know, it's around 1850, what we begin to see is the Democratic Party is looking forward to the election of 1852. And they're trying to figure out, they see the failure of Miller-Fillmore going on. They're like, this should be a win.
Right.
And they started putting together the platform. Now, uniquely to Franklin Pierce's situation, is Franklin Pierce was part of the platform. He was part of it. He was actually hugely influential on the structure of the platform. And he's an unelected official. So the Democratic committee, as it runs up to the Democratic convention, is looking for essentially a compromise. Now, there is something that gets referred to in this era of history, especially in political history, as the compromise era, where people were continuously making compromises to put off the inevitability of the Civil War. Well, that eventually percolated up to where we now started having compromise candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Zachary Taylor was not one.
He kind of was, wasn't he?
He was just such a big war hero, I think either party would elect. It's like if Eisenhower ran as a Democrat, he was winning. But I think Miller-Fillmore was. I think he was a down-ticket compromise. I do believe that. Mm-hmm. They picked somebody who agreed with everybody and then agreed with nobody.
Right.
So the Democrats are looking to field what they want to see is, you know, somebody who could unify the party. Well, it's hard to get better than that than Franklin Pierce. It is. But he's not this overly charismatic. He's gregarious as hell. But he's not this overly charismatic. He's a charismatic figure that the nation loves. He wasn't a war hero. He served in a war, but he's not a war hero. I don't want to make it sound like he played pretend going to war. That's not. Some people write that, and I'm like, that's not really what happened. Like, nah, it's not.
I mean, he's somewhere in between the two, I think.
Right. He's not Taylor, but he's also not Jefferson.
Right. Bravely running away.
Yeah, just being like, I don't want to be here.
Bravely ran away.
So he ends up attending. He ends up attending the Democratic National Convention in Baltimore in 1852. Now, what's important to remember is Pierce was not the most polarizing national figure, and he benefited from not only just being well connected, but had not been identified as a champion of any of the factions within the Democratic Party at the time. So Pierce is where we...
So he's kind of a blank slate, I guess? Like, that's... Okay. So what came from his presidency, there really wasn't a whole lot to kind of let us know that was coming?
Yeah, there was really no signs of it when June 1852 rolled around.
That's wild.
So he was not... he was not a leading front runner when it started. He wasn't really even in contention, but he was well liked. People liked him. Like,
right.
One of the guys who walked around the convention, talked to the Southerners, talked to the Northerners, talked to like that weird mid-Atlantic Democrat that like at low key became kind of like a swing vote-ish piece, which is, I find very funny because there wasn't that many mid-Atlantic Democrats at the time. Like,
who's he running against too? Is it Winfield Scott?
So it's a good question on Winfield Scott. So Winfield Scott was kind of a free agent style of candidate, but because he aligned so closely with the idea of unionism, which obviously would see him leading the Union Army at a point very soon in the
just
future.
Just crazy because he's from Virginia.
Winfield Scott ends up running as a Whig and defeating, as we talked last week, defeating Millard Fillmore,
right,
as the Whig candidate. But it's a campaign that almost immediately has no legs to it. So as Pierce gains the nomination, that's where the term dark horse comes from. That was the first time that was kind of really used in U.S. politics, is he's seen as this compromise candidate. And it's, I don't want to say dark horse, that's the first time dark horse was ever used in U.S. politics. That's an insane sentence. But it's the first time, like, contemporary usage occurred.
Right.
And he ends up getting nominated on the 49th ballot because people just give up and they're just like, who's one guy we all like?
Huh.
And they're like, Franklin Pierce. His running mate's William King, who's from Alabama. I don't really have anything interesting to know about William King.
Okay, but
besides, his name's Billy King, which is funny to me.
How much do you think the slogan played in him that went in?
Because oh, that's a pretty good. You, now we pierce you. That's a pretty
right?
good. That's a pretty good slogan. But how much did Millard Fillmore being a horrific president?
He wasn't running again. Was we just thinking that generals die after a year of office? I mean, Zachary Taylor and funny. Henry Harrison, like both of them.
That is true.
Right? It's like, maybe take a break on the generals. They don't seem to handle the stresses too well.
And then they elected a brigadier general.
Well, he was a brigadier general.
I'm joking. So he runs against Winfield Scott in the election of 1852. And it's a beatdown. So Winfield Scott wins 4 states and territories. Should say he wins Kentucky, Tennessee, Vermont, and Massachusetts. Mm. What a weird! And that goes back to the long, deep-seated rivalry between people from New Hampshire and people from Massachusetts.
I was just gonna say, do they hate each other that much?
Oh yeah, no, they're very,
like even Vermont too.
Vermont's its own thing.
Yeah, they're weird syrup cartels.
So yeah, right. So he totaled up Winfield Scott. 42 electoral college votes. I mean, just not even remotely.
Not even close.
Yeah, not even remotely close. So after, and this kind of goes, he's elected and, unfortunately, his only surviving son passes away in January of 1853. And there's a lot of optimism. There's a lot of optimism with Pierce because the Democratic Party was viewing him just before, this is like November 1852, but this obviously carries through his inauguration and early presidency, as the standard bearer. He goes from this compromise, and this is a funny thing that gets lost with Pierce. They act like he's a compromise candidate his entire electoral run. No. Mm-hmm. He was a senator. He was a rep. He knows how to be a politician. He's not a dark horse as if they just grabbed some guy. Truman. He's not, I was working in a furniture factory, now I'm the president, and I'm going to drop
Chris Rock and head of state.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, it's the guy's problem. Sometimes we overplay that story. But no, he's not. The Democratic Party actually breathes a sigh of relief at one point and goes, okay, we got Franklin Pierce. Like, oh, okay, we got somebody who knows how to operate. This will be good for us.
And
they will be proven wrong on that. They will be proven wrong. And so obviously next week we will cover the short but very concentrated ilks that make up Mr. Pierce's
concentrated. Ooh, I like the way you said that. Well, as Eric just said, you can join us next week. We'll get to see how Mr. Pierce wields his power. But while you are waiting, I want you all to go into the comments, pretend like it's 1852. Comment section is that ballot box, and I want you to cast your vote. And good luck picking a side in this one. Email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com if you want to keep your votes anonymous. Make sure you resurrect those thumbs and subscribe on your way out. Visit the website to stay up to date. We'll see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.